This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, and on ABC Radio National, this is the Philosopher's Zone. Well, last week we looked, in the year of Sigmund Freud's 150th anniversary, at Freud, the philosopher of civilization. This week we're turning to Freud, the scientist of the mind. Or perhaps that ought to be the would-be scientist, which is why this is a philosophical issue. The distinguished philosopher of science, Karl Popper, said that Freud's theories could not be science because they were not falsifiable. In other words, Freud had not stated what sort of evidence would, if it turned up, force him to abandon his theory. And if you don't do that, then your theory is proof against any evidence the world can throw at it. By definition, it can't be disproved, and a theory that's true by definition can't be empirical science. But was Popper right? And if he was wrong, might there nevertheless be other reasons for abandoning Freud's theory? Well, this was in part the subject of a debate staged in April during a conference held at the Center for Consciousness Studies of the University of Arizona. The motion was, Freud's dream theory is misguided and misleading. It should be abandoned. It was proposed by J. Allen Hobson of the Harvard Medical School, with Mark Soames of the Royal London School of Medicine speaking against the motion and for Freud. So this week we have an edited version of their spirited exchange, beginning with Allen Hobson and the case against Freud.
We need to know what we're debating about. What is Freud's dream theory? There are three cardinal points. One is that wishes are the instigators of dreams, and in fact, they are repressed infantile wishes, and that these infantile wishes welled up from the unconscious in sleep and needed to be disguised and censored. That's the heart of the theory, that dream bizarreness was the result of the mind's active effort to conceal these forbidden unconscious wishes, which would otherwise interrupt sleep. And so we now have an alternative view about what causes dream bizarreness, which I'll explain to you. The third point is that dreams can be interpreted, and they can only be interpreted correctly by the use of free association to the dream material in a transference relationship with a psychoanalyst. I think that is both a mistaken statement, an erroneous statement, and that dream content can be easily understood in terms of the new theory without resort to either propositions one or two. And this theory, I think, can be rejected out of hand. In part of my reasoning, the hard reasoning, is that it's based upon 1895 neurobiology. And I'm going to suggest to you that the dream theory is a disguised theory derived from outmoded antique neurobiology and is not a psychological theory at all. There was no data collected or analyzed. All of the dreams that are discussed in The Interpretation of Dreams, the 1900 work, are Freud's own dreams. There was no attempt to be systematic and to collect other dreams and look at them and see what they were like. So the thing is really unscientific from the outset. And it has not been experimentally tested. We've had psychoanalytic institutes for 105 years, and I'm going to suggest to you that they have not been scientifically fruitful. They haven't generated hypotheses, they haven't tested hypotheses, and that even Mark Soames' own very important work is neither inspired by nor relevant to Freud's dream theory. Now, another reason for rejecting this as a scientific theory is Karl Popper's assertion that Freud's whole corpus of work is unscientific because it's untestable. And that's all I need to persuade you about today, is that this theory is really untestable and is therefore not a scientific theory and should be rejected. I'm going to go much further than that, but we can accept the hypothesis as stated on the basis of Popper's objection. Again, I hope Mark Soames will comment on the way in which the theory could be proved wrong, because that, of course, is Popper's cardinal contribution, is to say that a scientific theory must be falsifiable. And I think what you'll see today is that as long as one clings to Freud's coattails, great man though he be, that there is an essential argument from authority and not an argument with respect to the content issues of the theory. There is a secret mystique about dreams. The psychoanalysts don't tell you what they learn, and when Mark Soames argues that psychoanalysis is going to save subjectivity and the study of first-person data, I think that that's a really preposterous assumption. I agree that we need first-person data, and I've argued that very strongly. I think there is nothing in the psychoanalytic literature that can compare with this rather modest and meager attempt to study dream phenomenology. Dreams are so compelling as scenarios or narratives that we tend to regard the reports as literature, and we apply essentially a literary approach to their understanding. But in fact, when one studies a language, one studies the grammar. The formal aspects of dreams are universal. All dreams that are really worthy of the name are hallucinoid. We believe in them as if they were real, despite the presence in them of robust cognitive difficulties. We have trouble remembering them, and we have trouble understanding them. And I'm going to suggest to you that the formal approach is very important, especially in mapping aspects of dreams down onto the brain. Now, Freud was wrong about so many things in neurobiology, and he can't be faulted for that. He lived in 1895. And at that point, the spontaneous activity of the brain was unrecognized. The fact that dreaming occurred throughout the night and not just in the instant before awakening, as Freud assumed, was not known. So naturally, he didn't have the scientific data on which to construct a more adequate brain-based theory. But furthermore, he thought that the mind and the brain were entirely stimulus-dependent. That's not the case. So he was forced to invent this notion of neuronal side paths, out of which the concept of the unconscious and the unconscious as a repository of unexercised infantile wishes was constantly feeding information that pressed for discharge during sleep. This assumption is incorrect. The unconscious as a repository of infantile wishes is probably also wrong. There's very little evidence that anything is remembered in terms of declarative memory before age 2 or 3. Infantile wishes may or may not be present in brain activity in some way, but we can never know that. Certainly, the idea that the unconscious is mainly repressed is wrong. We now know that most of the unconscious is cognitive. It can be gotten up with fair ease. Sometimes you have to dredge it. Sometimes you have to put your mind brain on automatic search to get the name of somebody like Karl Popper. But the brain is working all the time, and this is something that Freud was ignorant of. Now, the activation synthesis hypothesis, which McCarley and I put forward in 1977 as the beginning of an alternative dream theory, suggested that dreaming was caused by brain activation in sleep. At its lowest point of deactivation in non-REM sleep, the brain is still 80% active. So there's no wonder, then, that dreaming can occur in stages other than REM. But REM is the state which causes the longest and strongest dreams. I've left out an important aspect. That's the first aspect. That is not that you believe these things to be real, but what do you actually experience? You experience sensory motor hallucinosis. You feel like you are moving through the dream space, and you see the dream space very clearly. So the dreaming is hallucinoid, and Freud thought that this was regression, he said, to the visual side. Activation synthesis says no, it is a primary activation of the visual brain that results in dream hallucinations. And seeing is believing. We tend to believe them to be real, even though a moment's reflection upon awakening, regaining of self-reflective awareness, shows us that this could not be true. And in the presence of chaotic activation from the brainstem, and this is where the concept of randomness comes in, I think that the activation process is very unpredictable, very motivationally neutral. Then the forebrain does its best to understand what's going on and creates a dream scenario. And it does that on the basis of creating the best story it can under adverse working circumstances. Freud thought that dream bizarreness was a function of disguise and censorship. So for us, what you see is what you get. Dream content is the content. There is no distinction between latent and manifest content. It's not to say that one couldn't evoke interesting ideas by thinking about dream content. It's not against the idea of free association, but it is against the idea that that is a necessary way to go to understand dreams. Now, the emotionality of dreams is one point that Freud admitted, even in 1933, he really couldn't understand. Dream emotionality is primarily negative affect. And if it was fulfillment of wishes and those were adequately disguised, then why are so many dreams still extremely laden with anxiety? That, we think, is because there is a direct pathway from the REM sleep generator, which, as I've said, begins to operate at sleep onset into the amygdala, triggering these emotions in an automatic and, I think, completely unpredictable way. Now, one of the key points of the theory has to do with why dreams are so hard to remember. Freud thought that despite all of the Baudelaireizing of disguise and censorship, that still the material had to be re-repressed. For us, this is an unnecessarily complicated idea that dreams are characterized by a simple amnesia. The amnesia is related to the loss of noradrenergic and serotonergic and histaminergic modulation of the forebrain. All three of these neuronal systems start to decline at sleep onset and turn off completely during REM sleep. So I'm saying that the amnesia for dreams is a physiologically determined event, and it has nothing to do with repression or motivation.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and we're listening to a debate about Freud's dream theory. Alan Hobson of the Harvard Medical School has just given us the case against. So we have a central criticism of Freud, that his theory cannot be tested, and an alternative theory, that the longest and strongest dreams occur during REM sleep. That's deep sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And rather than being the expression of repressed appetites, they are the product of random activity on the part of the sleeping brain. And now, coming into bat for Freud, here's Mark Soames of the Royal London School of Medicine.
The most fundamental point in the theory is that the visceral body, the representation of the visceral body, the demand made upon the mind to perform work from the visceral body does not stop when we go to sleep. In other words, drive demands do not stop when we go to sleep. They activate instinctual automatisms no less in sleep than they do in waking life. Concomitant with this, the executive control systems, the regulatory, reality-oriented systems of the mind do go to sleep. As a result of these two facts, there's a shift in the balance between drive and executive control. This is the shift between, in Freud's terminology, between id and ego. The ego is weakened during sleep, the id comes to the fore. This, in Freud's theory, applies especially to the appetitive drives, what Freud called libido. The famous claim that Freud made that dreams are a royal road to an insight into the inner workings of the human mind arise from this shift in the dynamic balance. These more primitive, basic, biologically rooted drive states are less visible to our waking consciousness than they are during sleep, for the reason that the executive control mechanisms that normally hide them, being relatively weakened during sleep. The intrinsic meaningfulness of dreams arises also from this in Freud's theory. Because dreams are driven by these basic motivational states, they mean something. They tell you something about what the dreamer wants. Slightly less important is the fact that because motor output is blocked during sleep, we can't act on these motivations that arise during sleep. We therefore, instead of waking up and acting on them, we hallucinate ourselves acting on them. Dreams are imagined actions which occur instead of real actions. That is the hallucinatory aspect, the regression aspect that Alan referred to. Because there's a regression back onto perceptual systems, the dream thought is turned into a concrete picture. And this is one of the reasons why dreams require interpretation. They're a bit like hieroglyphics. You might have the thought, I want to teach Alan Hobson a lesson. And what you dream is Alan Hobson sitting in his school uniform before you and you're a teacher in front of him. As you can see, the transformation of the thought into pictures immediately requires a degree of interpretation, turning the pictures back into the thought. Now, implicit in what I've just said about motor output being blocked and this being the cause for the hallucinatory regression is the notion, important notion in Freud's theory, that dreams therefore serve the function of protecting sleep. Because these motivational impulses are active during sleep, we have two choices, either to act on them or to do something else. And on Freud's view, this imagined acting, this hallucinatory regression, is what happens instead of acting in reality, so that we don't have to wake up. The issue of distortion and disguise arises like this. Freud says that the executive control mechanisms, the ego, is weakened during sleep. He does not say that it's switched off completely. There is some greatly reduced and degraded degree of self-monitoring going on during sleep. It's a shift in the dynamic balance, but not a complete obliteration of ego, not a complete obliteration of self-awareness. As a result of this, while these drive states are being represented in hallucinatory form, there is the possibility, in fact the probability, of a generating anxiety for the weakened, enfeebled ego. As a result of this, in a rather crude way, given its weakened state, it tendentiously tries to shift this hallucinatory process to try to suppress anxiety and create a more pleasing picture. Obviously, it's an attempt. It doesn't always succeed. Hence, the nightmares that everybody always says are such an impossibility to explain on the Freudian account. A last point, because Alan mentioned it, not particularly central, is that we forget our dreams. On Freud's theory, we forget our dreams because we wake up. And when we wake up, our executive control mechanisms come back to the fore. That's the same thing as to say we forget our dreams because we repress them. Now, on what grounds did Alan Hobson reject this theory? Whatever he may say now, and he says all sorts of things at different times, if you look at his publications from the 1970s and 1980s, you'll see that he rejected Freud's theory because he believed that dreams were identical with REM sleep. Sometimes he says dreams and REM sleep are identical. Sometimes he said dreams are epiphenomenal to REM sleep. And sometimes he says simply that REM sleep causes dreams. Why this is important is because REM sleep is, of course, an automatic, pre-programmed state. It happens every 90 or 100 minutes during sleep, no matter what your childhood was like, no matter what happened during the dream day. It's a completely basic physiological, cyclical, intrinsically meaningless state regulated at a level of the neuroaxis at which very little of mental consequence occurs. For Alan Hobson, as he again said now, therefore dreams are intrinsically meaningless. The basic causal mechanism underlying dreams is meaningless. It's a basic pre-programmed physiological state. Whatever meaning there is in dreams is applied retrospectively, trying to make sense of this intrinsically chaotic, random process. Something like, as he's often said, projecting meaning onto an ink blot. So it was on this ground that Alan Hobson claimed that the Freudian dream theory is misguided and misleading in its essence. Now, is this a valid basis for rejecting the Freudian theory? It's not. because dreaming is not identical with REM sleep. Dreaming is not an epiphenomenon of REM sleep. Dreaming is not even caused by REM sleep. You can have dreaming without REM, and you can have REM without dreaming. Now, for me, the most important and most closely related to my own work, a bit of evidence against this view, is that not one single case has been reported in which loss of REM due to a focal brainstem lesion resulted in loss of dreaming. That is the absolute basic requirement of brain behavior correlation. It's the ABC of brain behavior correlation. If you're going to attribute a function to a structure, you must show that lesions to that structure lead to a result of that function. I've tried very hard to find a patient with a brainstem lesion who stopped dreaming, and I've yet to find one, both in my own research and in the entire literature. By contrast, there are literally thousands of cases in the literature and hundreds in my own work where the patient loses dreaming as a result of a forebrain lesion, completely separate from the brainstem mechanisms that regulate REM sleep, with preservation of REM sleep, who nevertheless have a total cessation of dreaming. So there again, we have this double dissociation that I'm talking about. Dreams and REM sleep are two different things regulated by two different sets of brain mechanisms. So Hobson's theory of what causes or explains dreams is simply wrong. And since this theory is what he used for rejecting Freud's theory, we have to say that his rejection of Freud's theory is unfounded. He should therefore withdraw his rejection of Freud's theory. Instead of withdrawing it, what he's doing now is coming up with all kinds of new ad hoc arguments against the Freudian dream theory. I'm afraid it appears he has prejudged the issue and is not basing his arguments anymore on the evidence. One more example: if we're going to accept Freud's dream theory as proven, then we might want to test the sleep protection hypothesis. My prediction would be that patients who stop dreaming due to parietal lesions, due to lesions in this posterior projection area, these patients whose motivational structures are still intact and who therefore should have the same impetus to dream during sleep as all the rest of us, patients who, due to parietal lesions, nevertheless can't dream, these patients should have more disturbed sleep than appropriate controls. In other words, the sleep protection theory can be tested directly by seeing whether patients who are unable to produce a dream when they need one wake up. I'm busy testing that hypothesis myself. So far, I have one case, and Bischoff and Bassetti have published 2 years ago one case in which patients with lesions there, with cessation of dreaming, present with sleep maintenance insomnia. So far, we've only two cases, but let's see. The point is that I would be happy to accept that the sleep protection theory is wrong if we can't show that sleep maintenance insomnia is a common concomitant of cessation of dreaming with parietal lesions. The important thing with respect to the topic we're debating today, however, is that the Freudian dream theory has not yet been falsified. It therefore is not fair to abandon it on the basis of a wrong conclusion reached 20 years ago. I would say that the guiding of current research efforts, making use of the Freudian dream theory, is a perfectly reasonable way to proceed. It's the way in which I'm proceeding. I'm using it as a very complex, sophisticated theory of the mental processes involved in dreams. And the aim of using it is in order to refine it, extend it, correct it, and ultimately to replace it. Of course, nobody wants to preserve a 100-year-old theory just for the love of it. It's the value of the theory is that it has more at this point that's right with it than the alternative theory that Alan Hobson has proposed for us.
Mark Soames. And whether you come down on his side or Alan Hobson's, he did give us a nice summary of what many philosophers say you should do with an existing scientific theory. Refine it, extend it, correct it, and ultimately replace it. He also described a number of what are called crucial experiments to decide between two competing theories. The Philosopher's Zone is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week by Luke Purse. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with more philosophy of science, when, as part of Radio National's celebration of the year 1956, we look at the life of a man who fled Hungary in that year and became a controversial philosopher in the West, Imre Lakatos.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. and we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.